Let's pray.
Where did that everyone can't hear me?
No, it's
speak up.
Can you?
Oh, okay.
No. Who cannot hear me?
You might want to project a little.
A little bit?
Yeah. It's just a fair bit of ambient noise.
I hate yelling like this. We can't, Mike. Okay, anyway. I guess most of you know me from the little hole in the wall here in Delaware School of Photographic Arts. I guess I better talk a little bit about where I came from to give you an idea why the school began. I don't have the big backgrounds that maybe a lot of you had. I started photography quite late as sort of a career, 28, 29. Never had a camera. As a kid, my uncle didn't have a darkroom that I played in. I had an athletic background. Did a bit of psychology and took to photography as probably a way to get a job. When you studied photography in Ottawa back then, you were trained to be a lab technician and not a photographer. So what happened was, after I graduated from college as a lab technician, I got a job right away in a custom lab. You might know the lab, Pro Photo, a long time ago.
Remember that?
Custom lab, way deep in Gatineau, Pro Photo, as a custom color printer. And I got a bunch. I'm going to talk about it in a way that all the breaks that I got. So that I land this job, and in 3 months, one of the printers gets ill. They throw Josef Karsh on me. And Josef Karsh had this company called Little Wings. Little Wings was his commercial company. And they would, they said, look, we need you to do this color print work. So it was 8x10 transparency. We'd come in and we'd make what we call 4x5 intern negatives and print them. And he, the old man would come down. I didn't see him a lot. He kept his distance. You were a worker. You'd do things like the Mulrooney family portrait. I did a piece for him on Havel. You remember the Czech president? Havel?
Lots of Havel.
Right. And it was work like that, all color work, very kind of positive. And Josef would come down, and you'd have to make 10 prints for him, and he'd cross out the ones he hated. We didn't get along very well. I printed 2 yellow for him. He liked red. He just kind of just, I got very close to his brother. But through this, I got to work with him and work with people like Willie McGilligott and Paul Couvred. And so I was lucky to get right into the game, I guess, in the commercial world. The lab closed for some reason, and I forget why, and I landed in odd jobs. And then I decided, okay, well, let's go on my own. And I met up with someone that I partnered with, and we started a portraiture business. And I started to look at interesting techniques in black and white printmaking. So I had a studio on Parkdale, had a dark room in the Glebe. Really went after upper middle class customers, started to do high profile people, worked only in black and white, worked only in large format, either 8x10, 4x5, Hasselblad, same look, same studio, no smiling. This was a little about retail portraiture, and started to work with the technique of bleaching with all of my work. So printmaking was the driving part of the work. And if people know what bleaching is, it literally is using a combination of potassium perchlorate and fixer. And literally, prints would come out heavy in the lab, and you'd start to lift part of the print up. And that would stretch the print so I could get white whites, heavy mid-tones, and deep blacks, and really bring the print to another level. And that's how I did all of my work. It's complete bleaching. And so it secured an aesthetic that people locally in Ottawa said, oh yeah, that's your work, we can recognize it. Started to get tension more, it's sort of in the political world, they started doing portraits of politicians and deputy ministers, and you know, as working artists, we lived off of people that lived in Rockcliffe and Glebe and Manitic, and you know, we actually got to a point where we commanded a sitting fee. We had hit a point of $700 a sitting fee. Prints were selling back then for $400, $500. And it got to a point that we got commissioned to do work as opposed to, let's look at the contacts and I'll pick number one or number two, number three. That we got to a level, which was great, that do the portrait.
Who was your partner then?
This woman named Christia Yanishevsky. At that time, Algonquin College came calling and said, look, you want to look at a couple of classes, you want to teach basic sort of printing classes. And I hummed and hawed about it, and I thought about it, and I said, sure, I'll look at it. And I did it on the weekends, and it was great. I enjoyed it. Got to sort of meet new people, impose my kind of my language to them. My mentor, in a sense, was a commercial photographer in New York called Irving Penn. Had communicated with him a little bit, but not really much. His work really influenced my work. I really looked at his approaches more than anything, I was doing commercial work a lot, so I really liked his approach as far as he was grounded in commercial work, but again, produced his own work, and it was a model I really enjoyed. Algonquin College went well on Saturdays. That the same group took the class again, and then the college says, hey, do you want to just run your own classes? And that was coming on. At that time, my partner was going through some issues, and so she had to deal with stuff. So I was looking to do more commercial work. And I met up with another colleague of mine, Martin Lippman. And this was 2000. He says, I will give you a retainer every week if you do my Photoshop work. Well, I didn't know anything about it. So I was getting paid to learn Photoshop. It was fantastic. This was before CS. Five, I guess.
I don't remember.
No one. We didn't have any lessons or anything like that. So that was happening. Algonquin College was happening, and then the dreaded call comes in from Gary Carter at the college saying, "You want to look at the full time program?" Well, because it's a bit of a tease because. They pay double what we pay our teachers now, you know, back then. And, I mean, the colleges pay a lot of money for full-time. And I was working, so they gave me a 16-hour print supervision darkroom week. At that time, I had a class of 84 students, can you imagine? You'd divide it into 20s. And in a vocational college, you lose 20. You don't know where they go. They're gone. You've got about 30 students that are on, and the rest sort of disappear. And the college, I thought, was quite organized. I said, well, do you have a curriculum? And they just do whatever you want. Well, that was great for me, but what happened? So I started doing what I wanted. We're really elevating prints. I got into composition with them. And they gave me the entry-level students. So this was all going great, and the work was coming out, and showing really well. The second-year students complained to the dean about, why can't Mike show us this, and which was really flattering, but it was kind of a nail in the coffin. I knew that Gary... Well, we were just doing a little more elevated work, because I got... I wasn't stuck on a curriculum, so I developed my own. Second years asked me to come into their classes, which I think the program really didn't want popular instructors, and I can understand that. I have no ill against that. And I couldn't go back the next year because of union issues. It's very, you know about it, really. So I had, and so everything was great. It was sad to leave because I started working, and in this group of students, you might know one of them was Angelina McCormick, you know Angelina, and there's a few other that you might not know, Patrick Turner, Brandon, and so it was all great. I knew I'd leave, I was still teaching part-time. I had an exit interview saying, oh, how'd the year go, and they were really happy, and I made the point of saying, well, you got about 3 or 4 students that you have to look at and maybe take care of a little bit. They're, you know, they've got something that's even beyond what I have, and I really. And the coordinator just looked at me, and he was not interested. And my rage in my brain and my heart started to go. And if I had to point out the reason that spow began was out of anger, because then I said, well, who's going to take care of these? They still need help. Who's going to really, really work with them? So, you know, I buried the anger as usual. I went on with my life, blah, blah, blah. 2 weeks later, emails start coming in. Michael, we're not going back.
This is your students?
Yeah, we're not going back. You should go back. Da, da, da. 5, 10. After 10 came, the email came and says, start your own school. Oh, God. Well, this is like, are you crazy? That is an impossibility. At the time, I had hired Kalia. I don't know her. I got her to run a couple of printmaking workshops with me. She was kind of into liquid light. And so I had her beside me sort of nagging. She said, well, let's look at it. Let's try it. You know, she wanted to do something. And these 10 students were pressing me on it. 10 became 15. 15 became 20. So I had to really think about it. And I said, ugh. And part of me didn't want to, because that first year, those students sacrifice. They don't get anything. Because it's going to be all about starting school and not about concentrating on them. So I was really hesitant. Took a long walk and said, decided. So, end of June, end of July, I had 43 days to build a school. So that's, and we had nothing. I mean, everything was on the floor, no curriculum. I had these 20 kids sort of staring at me. They're young, a lot younger than the students that we get now. So, they were all into building the school. It was this big thing they were going through. In the back of my mind, I was saying, oh God, what did I get myself into? And of course, now the rigor of the curriculum and okay, so what is my real intent in this place? What am I trying to achieve? And at first I thought about, well, let's mirror the Algonquin program with a little, you know, switches. We'll do photography and assignments. And then I had to stop. I said, no, no, no. My whole point was all this was a training ground for visual artists that just happened to be using the photographic medium. And if I kept it at that, is in the full-time studies. So when that started to happen, then this sort of uncivilized school began. That is a very open concept, riddled with tons of problems, tons of angst, an environment that I kind of like, that creates creativity, I guess. So you take everyone in, and everybody's crazy, and somehow work is the thing that comes out. And so that's how it sort of began. It wasn't money wasn't an issue at the time. I mean, we totally funded the place with tuitions and not grants. We had no idea, right? I made the decision in January, I think we better start a part-time culture for people that want to look at photography in the city. and that went really well. So it was a lot of hours. Still is. The board of directors are telling me not to put in the hours anymore. I think I'm annoying everybody now. But I mean, we're looking 6 days a week, 10-15 hour days. I mean, you had to wash the school, you had to take care of the books, you had to, you know, and then you had to deal with students and making sure that an elevated language starts to come out of this place. So that's sort of how it all began. You guys can interrupt me anytime when I'm doing this. Is this interesting at all?
I've heard rumors before, but never the straight word.
Yeah, I mean, there were difficult moments in starting the school. I mean, I took 20 students from a college. Well, that's money that they lost. The college and the school has never come together yet. The only person that is there that connects with the school that is sort of understands what went on was Russell Mills, who's been very nice. Russell Mills also is chair of the NCC, but he runs the media department at O'Donnell. He was very kind to me the whole way. He's come to shows and he's been there. And he's the one who told me, well, soon one day we're going to, might have to bridge us and, you know, you become part of the program. I don't think that's going to happen. So the school is now 8 years. We're going into our ninth year. We are still struggling. We're in the process of registering as a private career college now. That is a law that we have to abide by. We are also awaiting our confirmation of becoming a charitable status, which could fundamentally change the whole landscape of the place. I'm now getting educated in how other schools run. So just to give you an example of how, where we are compared to other schools, 90% of the schools we examine are fiscally divided in a 50% tuition revenue and a 50% granting or funding, both municipal and national level. So that's how they raise, that's how schools are run, whether it's colleges to most of the private schools. Yours truly is 93-7. So that's our, we get 7% money coming in from private donors to a few project grants here, and the rest we have to be fiscally on or we're not going to cut it. And we want to pay our teachers as best as we can. And so those are the struggles that every day that's happening. And hopefully now, with new people that are going to help run the school, there is a more drive and more manpower to deal with that end. The visions of the school, again, I now at a point, it's so funny, I don't own my school anymore. A staff member now. I don't have, the reason for the board of directors is to get access to different funding projects, and I cannot sit on my own board of directors as a voting member. I am considered staff now, so they can fire me. For a big severance package pretty soon. Hello! Again, I am compelled to train artists. If I had to, I was thinking about it all week. I mean, what am I going to say? What can I really say? And I'm just compelled by it. I like training all different kinds of artists. I might not be that good at it, but I'm certainly motivated by having a studio, and we call it the studio there a lot. That is this place where people collaborate. The part-time culture is a little different because obviously the students that go there are not there all the time. So the part-time culture is so relevant to the school, both in a fiscal way, but also both in a community way. It brings people in, as you know, as some of our instructors are here know. It serves as a recruiting development. So my one weakness is I use sports out analogies all the time to tell you what we do there. And I approach the school when I work with a student from a practitioner's point of view. So I try not to talk up here, but I try to talk here. And we work to work out together as much as we can. Then I got the whole intellectual community to come down and hammer everyone down and talk at them, which is okay. When we invite crits in from people like Michael Schreier or Sandra Dick or Guy Berube, well, that introduces them to a new language as well. And they can sometimes hit them very hard, and that's okay as well. So that's where I'm at as far as the vision. The other part is this idea of what do we do when they leave? And everyone says, well, Mike, that's not your problem. But, you know,
What do you mean in terms of guiding and all other things?
How does the culture around them, locally, internationally, internationally, how do we bridge, how are we helping our artists? I guess I've got that in the back of my head all the time. We have no reps, we have no agents. Everyone knows I'm at war with gallery owners, that I want them to work even harder for their artists, sell work that they can live. So I'm dealing with that. I don't know, it's easier actually to place the younger student that graduate in a commercial sort of environment. They can easily go to Toronto, they can find work, they can get them assisting jobs. They can work at the archives and placements. That seems to be a little easier. But then we've got this emerging artist who has earned something. And I'm still struggling with how to help that, to bridge that. Then, of course, we look at, so you're keeping the wet labs, eh? What's going on with the dark rooms, eh? Why are you keeping the dark rooms? And everyone's asking us. And everyone thinks it's... where a lot of people are thinking it's a big romantic thing, the dark room and the larger, and it has nothing to do with the romantic kind of sort of antique quality to the dark rooms. Though in the part-time school, a lot of people, it's a lot of fun, it's new to work in the dark rooms. The dark room at Spal and the dark room we developed there, the wet labs, is a training ground for printmaking only. Nothing else. It forces that photographer, that artist, to look at the relationship of density and contrast. I mean, it's that simple. They have to make different strips in order to see the comparison. They have to make the photograph. Our workflows are exactly the same, especially mine, that if they're creating platinum work, cyanotype, wet plate, silver gelatin, inkjet, the workflow is the same. The concentration is the same. The idea of seeing a print plane down, lifting parts of the print out, that new language has to come. So the darkroom is really, really important for training that. There is a craft element. Some people will take working with their hands. Some people won't, but they still have to go through that process. The second part of the analog culture at Spal is the medium and large format culture. What I call the optical language. That we don't train in DSLR very much, though students have the freedom to work in it. That I want to let people see the different optical language of large and medium format work. It is a different animal completely. and it, you have to work in it and you have to see it. And I look at the players out there, the people that are working, the people we celebrate, and, you know, that DSLR shooter is struggling. I mean, it's a very common photograph. So what does the DSLR shooter now do? Well, they have to be very much content-driven. They might have to deal with multiple images, composites. Helbig here's got to get up 10,000 feet in the air, and the conversation is about that. There has to be a lot more, and I'm now being, that's my personal take on it. I'm not being. So when I, you know, why are we responding to Eddie Bertinsky all the time? What's going on there? Is it his content? Maybe. You go to one of his shows, and you can't help but look at the spectacularness of his work. You look at it. There is something happening. They're both. Yeah. There is an optical language that is having you look at the work. There's something else that is happening.
There's conceptual what he's doing.
We look at Sally Mann. So you have to understand that, and this is my school, so I get to promote the artists that I judge. You know, the heroes at Spau are people like Avedon, people like Penn, people like Sally Mann, people like Diane Arbus. I seem to be concentrating on
his heroes.
My heroes, on the New York boys and girls. William Wegman, I mean, he spent his career photographing his dogs, 20 by 24 Polaroid. Evergone is a one that we know was back to Spau. So we look at these, and one of the common areas that they have in is that they look at that large format capture. And so that's very much around. It's about 8-10 cameras. We got a 10-10 and larger. We make our first year students purchase medium to large format. So even though they will go to the DSLR eventually, they learn to work in it and see it out. Listen, I saw files from a D800. They've perfected it. It's perfect. It's smooth. Transitions are right. It has nothing to do with that. We keep the analog screen because of the relationship of lens, plane, object plane, lens plane, and film plane. That's the reason. And I'll tell you, you make me a full chip 8-10, I'm in, baby. I'll burn the dark room.
What about the medium format?
That too, but they don't. They don't give you the full range.
Yeah.
And you bring it down under $50,000, I might be able to do something with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I'm being subjective here, but I'm really, that is one of the main reasons why we're keeping this analog culture. We keep dry mount presses, we keep matte cutters, we want the students to go through the process, see what happens. We want them to build their own show if they can. And it's not fun. I mean, the big part of the school is very stressful. You in training artists, and I call them artists because I really believe that's what they are, their ability to adapt with failure is massive. How do you bring them up? Same way when they're up high, how do you chop them down and you make sure they're grounded? They're creative blocks. Can destroy them. I had a group this year, probably the most conceptual group I've had the whole time at Spau, where photography was in their brain. There was such a lack of production from this group because they were thinking about so many things that they just didn't make work. That wasn't the problem. And my next group that's going to come in is going to be the other way around. They just make work. So it's very different. So you deal with this all the time. Yes?
So I was trying to get a print out of you from the print shop. And your excuse was that you had 2,000 prints to do for these students.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they not making those prints?
Okay, so there's a couple of reasons.
Because you end up having a big job.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons for that. It's hard to, if you don't own a printer,
okay,
it's very hard to learn how to use your printer. I have many students that own printers that never use their printers. And even when you instruct them how to use their printers, it doesn't work that way. Two, we've got such a system now that it's really not about me working hard necessarily, because I get to work with a student every day. And so as we're making prints, we're talking about the work and designing and working out the work. So that helps too. And also, when I was at the college, they allowed their students to print their own photos. And I would watch this. I'd stay in the print labs, and they would print 18 copies of each piece and make changes. And the school would go through about $60,000-$70,000 worth of ink in like a 2-week period. Well, we just can't afford it.
Yeah.
So we have to be efficient as hell. Plus, these kids, I mean, we've got students that build 30-piece portfolios, 40-piece books, 60 pages, 80 pages, 20 pages, 3 books. They create photo books, right? So it's a lot of work. So it's just more of a managing thing and not a...
So you do most of the printing for the portfolios?
We do all of it, that's cool, yeah.
Yeah.
Except for her. And Rena, yeah. Rena, if I was Rena, I'd put the shingle on the wall and say, printer for hire.
Sure.
She can make prints.
Yeah.
She's got a printer.
Yeah.
So she worked through it. And I didn't even show you how to use it. We played around with a couple of new profiles, but that's it, right? She knows how to use her printer. Teaching that to 20 kids that don't even own printers, it's just a management thing. Maybe that'll change one day.
It really shocked me.
It's a lot of work for me.
Your photography is all about print.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So if they're not,
they don't have a printer.
Yeah. Well, why not? They have a camera. How do they get a printer? They got to buy it. And then they got to eat ink.
That live on $3 a week of it.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised that the culture that can afford printers, they still come to me and says, can you make this print because I don't want to touch my print. There's a big population like that.
Whole course on it.
They just don't touch it. That's just one of them.
Yeah.
Hi.
Do you have data or testimonies from students who have been out there for 4 years, 6 years?
We're not bad. We're pretty good. I mean, I'd have to go back to the office and we have a file and see where everyone is. So I would say like our percentage is pretty good. I would say out of 10 students that graduate every year, 5 to 6 will connect still and work. So that's a really good percentage rate. What we're noticing though is younger students don't want to do it. So we get a lot of pros that ask them, hey, do you want to assist? They don't want to do it. I put 3 kids in the archives. One kid, they were really looking at, and it dawned on him, he's 24 years old,
and he
spent every day on a 750 and scanned old negatives. After 3 months, he started to look at it, and he says, I can't do this the rest of my life. Gone. And if I find that they tend not to want to stay in the menial jobs or the early entry photograph jobs. So a lot of them are surprised that we're trying. I can almost get work for everybody or certainly support some endeavor that they want to try. I can virtually almost say I can do it for everybody. They won't like everything, but I can virtually do it, but I can't get them. Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to make the same point I made the other day when it was my turn to speak, and I want to thank you, Michael, because I think your approach, which is to support and encourage and advocate on behalf of artists, I think is just phenomenal, commendable, and in fact, it's that little push that got me to where I am, just that sort of conference you gave my work, and your response to that. So yeah, it's just and to tie in with that observation, unlike I think any other arch-oriented organization, whether public or private, NGO or whatever, I think you and by extension SPOW is the only organization that I'm aware of that actually runs with that kind of ethos. Almost, especially all the other ones that I know are there for themselves. So they sustain themselves. There's an internal bureaucracy, whatever it might be. That's the imperative around which these people operate, that work in these places, and they're not particularly interested in artists or art per se. They're more interested in sustaining themselves off of that. The worst example of that, I suppose, is the forever requests that I certainly get as an artist, and I'm sure get the same here too, where people who are continually being asked to donate work to support these organizations that supposedly help artists. So highly commendable. I think that your approach is some I've heard in other countries that approach does that exists as well too.
Yeah.
So in that way, you are unique, and I think that is absolutely something that should be celebrated. So that's a kind of comment. The one of my things I puzzle with, and I see you grappling with this too in your presentation. And it is, and I'm not sure, but it is that it's like you are projecting into something of a vacuum in terms of a visual literacy, in terms of a broader understanding of what this means to be an artist and to engage in this, not only for craft, but to engage in terms of craft and content and vision. Three words that you are the motto of SPOW, and I think maybe that there is almost like a complete vacuum or a lack of places where you can get traction around the content and around the vision part in terms of there being ways to find hooks to in turn make SPOW grow. And in turn, feed back and make something happen in the broader art community or the broader community for the public writ large. But I really think that's also a place that we belong as well, too. It's not just this peculiar, little art community, I think, that we should be talking within. So I wonder if you have some comments about that.
Well,
how to project into that space, how to create that conversation that will actually give what we're doing some currency, which I don't think we have.
You mean on a broad base, not so much with connected to the school?
Yeah, in a broad base, but I think that feeds back, of course, into the school.
Yeah.
It's like the school's projecting into an empty space. And
a little bit. I mean, it's what I grapple with a lot. I mean, here I am, working with artists and we're getting some critical work out of them. Producing some very strong bodies of work coming out of school, flawed because there is someone like myself and a few other people that are stamping, of course, an aesthetic. Everyone talks about the SPOW look, and we're sort of working years to get rid of that. And we don't really have it, but our print work, certainly there's a concentration on that. There's guilt that goes through me saying that. So we build this all up, and then where are those bridges? Where are those? It's been a little bit of a project of mine to secure sort of relationships with the West Side Studio, to some of the galleries here, to a few places in New York. That I maybe get students here, but that's very slow, and I don't have the physical time to do this. I'm in meetings with former graduates that are looking at creating a representation culture that they're going to, but they have to go through such a learning curve. They have to stay for a long time in it. to get to that next level. They have the power. They don't know anybody. They want to build a little representation culture.
10 years.
10, 20 years. Least, you know. Yeah. I got there was a gallery in Westboro that closed down. Michael Guinness Gallery. You know, what a nice gallery. And he I don't think his expectations were so. Like, he thought he could turn a gallery over in a year. And this idea
they were very
of
high when you began.
That this he's got to build a stable of clients. That that have to he like Pierre Luc. I think Pierre Luc of Cellar on Hill is probably one of the best gallerists. That's a word that we have. He is not there for the vanity of the gallery. He is there to make money, which I like for the artist. And he moves product. And he's acting appropriately. He's not a fun guy to be around. He can be arrogant. He doesn't look at the photography very much. But he makes money for his artists, and we need more people like that here.
Can you talk with Patrick McHale?
Yeah, Patrick McHale is, I don't know him very well. One of my students, one of my first students, I get to have credit. I get to have credit for Jonathan Hoban as being student number one. He apprenticed with me for a year, and
okay.
So I'll take the credit, even though I don't deserve it. He was offered Pierre Luc, and he was offered Patrick McHale. He went to Patrick McHale because of his critical presence in the arts community. But Patrick is not moving product. There's no question about that. His sales are not good.
There are a lot of good galleries that also aren't interested in photography, unfortunately.
Yeah. Maybe not here as much,
but
there are, you know, there are more places in the world, New York, Toronto, LA, and that.
But he has a lot of photography. I mean, he has Michael Fryer.
Oh, yeah, okay.
No, he left him.
He left him? Oh, okay.
I was just going to comment on what you said. There's not a lot of galleries that sell photography in Ottawa, and I have at least one close-up perspective to one gallery owner, Claude Bertrand. Who we know so personally through several family situations.
Right? What's the gallery?
Good. And I've had a conversation with about selling photographs. Now I don't know whether he's changed since or whether I got the photo, whether I understood, but my impression in talking with him was very simple. He said, look, he's running full speed, full tilt, just trying to keep on top of what's happening in the painting world, and trying to make sure that he's making money for his artists, and he just doesn't think that he can afford to spend any time, and I mean any time, worried about photography, because he just doesn't think it's going to sell. So it's not so much the gallery owner, if I'm right, it's the buying public in Ottawa, or at least as far as this one gallery owner was telling me.
Not much sales.
Which again, one of the mandates of the school is to, there's a high concentration of what we call process-driven work as opposed to content-driven work. Content-driven work has a tough time in allowing that artist to go forward as much as. You know, if I looked at the sales of our grad show, that were quite high this year.
It was great.
It was all process driven work that we went out the door. You saw that, hey. And very, very accessible work. This is not work that's out there, a glass plate of a pineapple. It's not a lot of subtext there. Where someone like Rina's work is filled with subtext. I mean, super, super strong. The markets here specifically don't support it. It goes a little beyond the name. Whereas the process-driven work, the wet plates, the large format work, the still lives, the work that is, a guy like Peter Simpson, when we had our print show, he came to the very gracious, and we offered him any print he wanted. What did he choose? He chose a beautiful landscape. He didn't choose something that is going to certainly offend him. challenge him that much. It was aesthetically.
Who was his name?
Peter Simpson.
Peter Simpson.
Yes,
sir.
Is it,
in your opinion, a question of market size? But it seems to me that, let's call it fun, in Europe, for example, or in some markets in the U.S. seem to have more traction.
Exactly.
But
yes.
Here, this is a 1 million whatever.
Yeah, I don't
think
very
well
city.
Educated city.
Huh?
Very well educated city. Awesome.
I don't think I agree.
Yes,
with you. I don't think we have the markets. I really, you know, when you say a million, you know, upper middle class people that buy art. We're not, you know. I tell my students, I try to be brutally honest. You know, my mother, God bless her, goes to IKEA and says, "Oh, look at the pretty thing in the frame."
Yeah,
so, yeah. She's not going to buy art. She's a middle class pensioner that is not going. I don't know if we have. We don't have enough collectors. I mean, we have some. We have some really supportive collectors. Actually, the Collectors Group of Canada, the group that's here, fantastic. I mean, they have been so gracious to our place.
The worst comment that nature I heard regarding one of my pieces was something like, "Oh, my husband did something like this.
Yeah, exactly.
We haven't we should print it and frame it."
Yeah, yes. Go ahead, try that.
So listen to me. So this is my everyone harps about. Oh, why are you talking about large format? What do you mean when you talk? This is my harp. Is that, as simply put, the lay public doesn't have access to an 810 camera, doesn't have access to the products that we send out. So there is a newness to this. Maybe I'm just thinking like that. That why are we still looking at, why are the large format sales still going okay? So you know, Kinski, yes, he's on another one. Why is he not switching to the DSLR? Well, there's something going on there. You know, he takes his master techniques and flips it upside down, drops the front. You see him grab you in, big prints. And language. he's got smoke coming out of his ears. I don't know. I'm just saying, Jim shoots. He scans. It's large format capture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's going on there?
Yeah, I guess one thing I find frustrating is that I make a living. Selling fine art photography. Some years I make nothing. Some years I do okay. I'm not making a lot of money. Most of you here, your jobs make a lot more money than I do.
I'm on the board.
But I do scratch by and make a living. And I make that living almost entirely from people who have very little to do with the artwork. They come in and they see my work and they respond to it. They respond to its aesthetic. They respond to its content or some combination thereof.
But you're
sells.
Agreeing with me, man.
No, but
your camera is not your camera. Your camera is your airplane. Not too many people have an airplane.
No.
Actually, not too many people have two airplanes.
No. I agree that there is a little bit of a wrinkle that I bring to it that helps me.
Right.
But that isn't the full story. I mean, the full story is that people identify with the imagery, and it starts a conversation that starts within them, that they relate to, that in turn they project that into an image, and then they make a decision to seek me out and have a conversation.
I think your level of access is pretty good. I can't fly over the areas.
But I think you're confusing something, and I don't think it is. That is a little bit of a rub that helps me open the door. But that's ultimately, there's people possible doing the same stuff. They have the same access. I'm not the only person doing this kind of thing. But it is. But yet from there, I'm able to take it further. And it's because of the response that I get from people around both. Form, if you will, the craft, in some sense, to some extent, but you know, aesthetic, but also the content and some combination thereof. But I'm getting it in, you know, various ways. And,
no, okay.
So eventually, it becomes
what frustrates me.
Yeah.
Is I hear that there's no support here, like, you know, you have to go to Toronto, New York, or something, and I disagree. I think it's our problem that we're not creating the conversation, and that's back to my idea about there being a vacuum.
True.
About we're not creating a conversation in which we then are participants and or protagonists to create a market for ourselves. Sure, the people who do representation can do a better job, or some do a good job, some don't do a good job, but I don't see us ourselves projecting what it is that we do in a fashion that actually has an appeal to people who love it. And there's something there, and it has to do with content, and it has to do with not generating a conversation around the material that we produce. What your students produce, some of them, it's by no means even close to all of them, but some of them produce some content, and yet it's being pushed out into a vacuum. And unless and until we create some kind of a conversation and that engages, broadly put, we're not going to get anywhere. And to whine and complain that there ain't no market here, there's a million people in this market, they're well educated.
It's not like
it is our own responsibility at some level I think spouse in some level for what you're doing to create that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, as I sort of end in sort of my spiel, I wanted to end with that final vision of the school is, talk about the training, talk about the Red Lab, we talk about all the things and working with students, artists in residence. The last part of the puzzle, which relates to you, is creating an audience and educating an audience. So I used to say, well, I'm graduating 10 and only 5 or 4 or 6 are working, and I get all stressed, but I realize those are the 3 now have a language that they might be part of that growing audience. But I mean, you know, it's not going to happen tomorrow, right? I mean, it's can the school persevere and build up a bigger audience for photography? Yes.
We've been talking about sort of fine art photography, selling in galleries and whatever. You just mentioned the question of language, and going back to your own experience of how you started this whole talk, isn't there also something where someone going into some form of commercial photography comes in with a language and distances everybody else? He doesn't have a single print in any gallery whatsoever, but he's a wedding photographer, see, has a view perspective that nobody else has.
Yeah.
He's a food photographer, for that matter, and he has a perspective that nobody else has, and then he goes...
Supported 1,000%. If I could get more people interested in Ottawa is a tough place now commercially, you know, as we know, right? The commercial, we don't have a big marketing culture, not that much. We have a big government marketing culture. We don't have a publishing industry. We don't have a manufacturing industry. Most of my graduates that decide to go to do commercial work will have to, for the most part, get on a plane and go to Toronto, go to Montreal, go to Vancouver. The ones that can stick it out here, and I have, you know, 10 or 12 that are, you know, are making their ways. The school, I mean, I come from a commercial background, so I really support that. I think we underestimate the value of doing applied, we call it applied photography, whether it's weddings or portraits, food, events. I think there's so much value in that, because it keeps you there. It keeps you in this game. It's very easy to be in that and have a fine art division. And we have so many group shows that a commercial can lend the work out to somebody else. So I really support that. We don't do that enough. And I come, like I said, I come from a design background where I work with a lot of graphic designers and art directors. And they want creatives out of their commercial photographers. And I think that that word commercial is becoming a bad word, and it shouldn't be. Do you remember we used to have this term commercial artist? We never say that word anymore. Remember we say he's a commercial artist.
That's a great term.
That word has gone away a little bit. We don't talk like that. Commercial artist could be someone who is an illustrator, someone who could draw, and they were recognized. And right now, there's this little bad thing that once you start your little photographic career, you do weddings and you do retail portraits, that is this bad division you get there. And I think they're not supported enough, actually. So those are great.
How do you see the relationship, not to switch topics, I think it's all similar topic.
Yeah.
How do you see the relationship of SPAL with the university photography programs,
that's a good
School
question.
Of Art, Ottawa School of
Art? We work a little bit with them. Certainly Ottawa U, there's certainly communication there. The Algonquin College, we don't at all. There's no real relation there. OSA, we've done some projects. How do I view it? Lorraine Joubert came to our show one year and said to me, the problem with a relationship with you guys is I can't get students like you. The program doesn't allow for that type of work to come out because, one, it's a big program. They just don't have the attention that they can get in our school. And even our school, we don't give enough attention because we're so busy. Every now and then, I do dream about, and it's happened in the U.S. a lot, and I forget where, I think it was in Syracuse or Rochester, where Ottawa U or Carleton U is going to pick us up and just drop us in their parking lot. And we run out of them. This is something that, it's something that we've talked to the university about a little bit, just in a very casual way, and sort of to have the School of the Photographic Arts as part of the university, but it is independent within, and there are schools like that in the U.S. Because we're a funny little school. I mean, we get criticized by the colleges to be too artsy. We get criticized by the university too polished. We're hit everywhere a lot of times. I like the connection to the university more than the colleges because of the critical language they might be able to help us with. Colleges I stay away from because I personally worry about technology-driven courses and the culture because I got kids coming in, I'll tell you, they know way more than I'll ever know. You want to learn, I don't know Lightroom, Rena can attest to that. I got kids coming in to learn Lightroom in an hour.
Yeah. They have the time too, though.
I am not going to, I'd rather connect with the university cultures from a language and a critical theoretical point of view than how do I use this new program that's coming out, right? So,
just an observation, and this is the question, a great one in terms of the connection to commercial work, and I don't do very much of that. Once in a while, someone asks me, I'll do some commercial work, but that's it. But the fact that you are open to it, I think, is instructive, and when I think what happens in the university culture there, that's in fact that's part of that culture is in fact to close the door to things that are deemed, in a sense, to be beneath it. Almost a reflection, a mirror of that barrier between vocational, and university training. Ironically, the vocational folks do much better than those with university degrees. But is there something there in terms of that kind of continuum of that could then be extended further, but then projects into the realm of ideas and the conceptual at the university?
Because
I think part of the problem is that we don't have that. We end up with these little silos. And if it's a way of breaking that down so that some of the social milieu, some of the social whatever that causes people not to talk to each other,
it's broken down so we can have
it's tough. I mean, you had talked about you said when we're talking about you haven't disconnected with the university culture
all the time,
bit, right?
Yeah.
I don't. I mean, I get along with them. What I find at the university language for me, what I see is that there's a mandate to show what art can be. Look, art can be this. Art can be that. The school operates on a different level where we sort of, I'm not too concerned about that. I just want to make the art. That I'm finding that I want my students coming out with an inventory of artwork that they forget about it and they make art. Well, you know, you go to the university cultures and it's very, very different. So it's hard to...
They want meaningful. They want photography as a...
Yeah, well, and they are pushing forward, right? I think universities should be that Mount Olympus of education, that hierarchy. And so they have to push forward. Maybe you don't realize the value of them.
I think there's something else at play here. And I think as the connection as institutions, I think that's what you're finding out.
Yeah.
It doesn't work so well. I think the connections at the level of individuals is more likely to succeed. The connection at the level of individuals.
Okay.
So an individual Ottawa U art student going to the year-end show at SPAL.
Yes.
That can work. That will work probably. And vice versa, by
yes.
the way. And I think what's going on with university is that for the last, pick a number of years, 50 years, maybe more, craftsmanship is not a value. Okay. We can say I'm for it, I'm against it,
that's fine
there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a historical fact. Art has thrown out craftsmanship as a value.
I
know
about that. I think that's
I've
had professors.
That's
too much.
It's
too much.
I think
it's
so. I think it's so forced conversation. There are universities where craftsmanship is still highly valued.
I think so too, yeah.
But I agree with you. In the past, there is when I was in New York a year ago, there was the Biennale or the big show at the Whitney Museum. It was so interesting to see the art, and everybody was walking out of there on the first floor like white, hated it, except for a few pieces where people really went to because of the craftsmanship.
Right.
And I remember reading in the Village Voice about the critic couldn't say, like, this is crap, because they're afraid to be sued. And it's what is happening in the arts right now. All the critics, it's like the Conservative Party. You get a gag order, if you criticize anybody, you get hit, basically. And I think it's what is happening in the arts right now. And I think if you look at the very good up today, there is still a lot of very good craftsmanship.
Yeah.
And to come back when you see that the kids are not doing their own print, I go, oh my God, I'm so afraid of the craftsmanship.
Yeah, but okay, hold on.
Let me get that.
I'm not a big. You know, for me the inkjet print. I mean, it's front ended, right? You do your work on a monitor. You improvise.
No. Yes, no.
No, let me finish. You do your
okay,
work on a monitor, you improvise, you make changes, you're on, you're off, you come back to it, you look at it. Frankly, I'm praying that the same feel comes out of my printer, right? I can't touch that printer.
Uh-huh.
That printer's a photocopy machine to me at times, right? Because I'm visioning it all on this electronic thing. I mean, we get so bored with inkjet printers, you know, Angela Walker, and we did a session where we're waxing inkjet prints and we're spraying them with varnishes just because we want to touch them. But once I go Command-P, I can't go into the ink and touch
it,
right?
You've done it up front. You're
done it up front.
Yeah. And then you
redo
it.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, it's a process.
Yeah.
It's
and that's money. It's a
financial
thing.
Right.
So I'm not when I say that, I'm a printmaker.
Yeah, if you follow the, like you were saying, you follow the traditional photography, the darkroom process,
yeah.
When I do my own printing,
but
sometimes I have 20 foot.
True, yeah, and that's I do that too.
But
I'm just saying it's just a money issue a lot of times.
Yeah.
It can cost
money. You know,
yeah, you know that, right?
You give them one.
So the monitors are, you know, especially the Apple monitors, they're quite exacting, as you know, that, you know, with the right type of profiles, like, you know, you're pretty good, and you do that type of printmaking up front. Trust me, I wish I could have the students print and make test strips, but we can't give everyone a printer. It's a big difference in putting a tray of developer on, and then they're off, right? And they can go, right? But bleaching, where I introduce that is a form of Photoshop with chemistry, right? We're able to go to each part of the print and deal with it. So, yes.
So I mean, the technique stuff aside, I think this little interchange is very useful. It's like kind of doing it both for you. So, what I see in that, in the reactions, is I see a conversation, and kudos to you, Jake, for I think you're the inspiration behind this, but correct me if I'm wrong, and you've kept it together anyway. And when I came to one or two of the presentations before I did my own presentation, I was just bowled right over because there was this very intelligent, thoughtful discussion going on, and yes, there was some argument. I think that is in fact maybe the answer. That's the discussion. We learn from that. It's not just, you know, non-criticism or whatever, you know, that is the old-fashioned. Kenyon Art apparently doesn't do criticism anymore, I've heard, in the magazine. So maybe this is, in fact, the model. I mean, I guess if indeed it is, what's sad then at some level isn't that your whole flock of students isn't here, you know, and hasn't been at these things.
Yeah, I know.
For some reason, the social... The social signals that are being sent are such that they're not going to show up here when they in fact should be showing up here.
Yeah,
there's something there that's not quite right in terms of generating a conversation that where we plumb into each other's experiences, which ultimately is what I think this is about.
I think it might be an age.
I really like what you're bringing up, like filling the void. And as soon as you said that, I agree. This is part of it. SPA is part of it. So where do we push it?
I
think you got to push it out into the public.
Well, Festival X...
Festival X is very good.
Is a great event that pushes photography out to the public.
So...
And it's part of the... You know, this is a 10-day, whatever it is, conversation, to use your term, it's got to have an impact.
Yeah. But it's twice, once every 2 years, so.
But
I think there's a lot of pressure on the artists now. I think artists have to do the difficult.
I tell my students that it doesn't
matter, you know, craft, no craft, that somewhere down the line, and I tell this to younger, because I think a mature artist can understand it, is that their degree of difficulty somewhere in their process, whether it's content, process, camera approach, I don't care what you call it, somewhere down the line, there's a difficult part to it that allows them to go forward. Okay, a lot of people, I went to the Pop Show. Remember the Pop Show that was here about 3 years ago?
Yeah.
Damien Hirst and all my students said, oh, you're going to hate it. I love the Pop Show.
I loved it too.
I think it was fantastic.
Fresh.
Damien Hirst is not a sloppy artist. He's tight.
He's playing a lot.
Warhol was tight. They weren't fooling around.
All the craftsmanship was there.
There was, of course, some really funny stuff. You know, but I mean, the core of the show was strong, and it was difficult to do. It was like, wow, look how complicated that is.
But I know that's
a simplistic thing. You're right. You can go to Manhattan, you can take an abstract painter, and just, he throws paint against the wall, and he's got work.
But it all comes from theory, what art is.
Right.
But I mean, in my view, for the most part, the lights are on, but there's no one home at the National Art Gallery. I mean,
there's
so little that it ends up being content.
I think we've been talking about commercial galleries and selling prints and whatever. Actually, if you look at non-commercial galleries, you see more and more photography, or more than ever.
Look
at the show at the National Gallery, the new acquisition show. It's a bi-annual triangle, whatever.
Yep.
I was floored to see how many photo-based pieces were there.
Yeah, very fantastic.
I wouldn't put a percentage, but it was more than one, right?
And people got a 25%. And I agree, people are educated enough to understand that there are vanity galleries, there are private galleries. The public galleries have the different mandates. It's not a sales culture. It's they have social mandates that they have to engage the public somehow through art. It's not like, oh, look at the cool photographs that my clients can purchase and hang in their house, and then they throw that out the window.
And they're also very content-driven.
Very content-driven. But I talked to Jonathan Brown, who runs the city acquisitions, and in talking to him, he said to me, he says, we're looking at pushing photography as our center in visual arts, that Ottawa is... whether it be the Karsh legacy, whether, you know, all these stuff, you know, that he said to me that he said more and more photography is looked at way more than we ever have, and it's maybe this mandate that photography does center Ottawa, that Ottawa is the one. Who knows?
But
you know, their budgets are low and small.
$100,000 a year or something.
I think it's two or something.
Okay. Is there something that could be done out of this environment here that becomes? I mean, change only happens to make it happen, and comes through debate and conversation. And is there something out of this that could be a nucleus tied with what you've put together over 9 years?
I think there can be. Here's my wording. How do we take care of the reckless artist? Who's going to take care of that?
Take care of who?
Take care of what?
Reclusive artist.
Quiet artist. Not all of us are like Tony, who does tremendous work, but he's like, yells at you, right? He says, here I am. He's on his blog. Everything's on. His dynamic. He works very hard. It's very difficult work, but he's on.
24 hours.
How do we take care of a quiet person who has to, won't come out here? I have a kid now, Dante. He's a real artist, this kid. He can barely get out of his house. He doesn't even like human beings. He's like this. Get away from me. I can't stand you. And he's dynamic. How do we take care? How do we take care of him? See, do you really think Jackson Pollock came out to these events? It's like breaking down gels like that and throwing paint on the wall, and someone loved him enough to lend his work out.
But Michael, what I see here, just in that very comment, is precisely that which is needed to support artists, to generate, create content, ultimately, that in turn feeds conversation, that in turn makes what we are doing have traction more broadly, and in turn, you know, becomes marketable, etc. So I think there needs to be a waterfront kind of a conversation that picks off little elements that are part of this, whether it's specifics like the ones you've described, or whether it's the specifics associated with technique, or, you know, what is Tony doing to get his message out there, talking about the roles of the public galleries and whatever else. I mean, there's so many different facets that are involved, and I think there's a nucleus here. When I see in SPOW, it inspires me. What I see here also inspires me. And I think that there are some bits and pieces. If we collectively put some thought into this, pick some of the things off, collectively, I think there's a possibility of making a change. your nucleus to turn this place, Ottawa, into a Santa Fe or whatever, it's here. There's no reason why that can't happen here. Sorry?
It's too cold?
With the winter, we have to get about Santa Fe.
Well, climate change is all that, no. But, no.
Santa Fe is cold in the winter.
But I mean... But
yeah, let's do it.
Well, I mean, the digital culture has sort of saturated a little bit, that it brought people out. They got their feet wet and kind of saturated the market, and then they pulled away. And it's people like Morrison here that he perseveres. He sticks it out. Yeah. That's
and
a lot of the people here, you stick it out, right or wrong, right? It's hard. It's not easy. You got to teach. Trouble getting galleries. Do you have a gallery of record?
Well, I've been displayed
in galleries. But who reps? Galleries. Jim Lamont.
Yeah.
Jim Lamont's a prolific landscape artist. I mean, who's helping him? He's doing a lot of work. He's not a lazy guy.
So what I'm really saying is, what, those 2 hours that you have left over at the end of the day, you can now start the gallery.
Yeah, no.
No.
And make money.
Sorry, I'm harping on money a little bit. I remember watching a documentary on Mordecai Richler, one of my favorite writers. He goes, whenever I get together with my friends, that's all we talk about is money. When I get with my writer's friends, because we've got to go forward in this.
My sense here is that we're into a very long term process, it's called generations. Because if you've been brought up in an environment where the notion of photography as an art form didn't exist, it's going to be really hard for you to change. And the question I have is, people who have been brought up in an environment where it's completely submerged with pictures, is this going to help or hinder their appreciation of photography as a quote art form? I don't have an answer to that.
Well, we do make, they're off to me, school, we do make a huge distinction between the image and the photograph. That the image is something else. The photograph is what we're after. The piece is what we're after. We're bombarded with images. The images don't mean as much as the photograph.
By photograph, you mean the hard thing.
Kalia. We're trying to come up with what is the school of thought at SPOW? What is our school? The Vancouver school. What is our school? And we're playing around with the new pictorialism, like this idea that the photograph as an object, and that's where it can only be, as opposed to.
So how can you possibly do that if you don't have people that actually print?
Okay. Yeah, well, they do print in the wet labs. I just need more money to get more printers to give everyone a printer. I just don't have.
I don't agree with that. I don't use my printer 24 hours a day.
Yeah, but it's hard.
They put out a lot of prints.
They put out a lot of
prints. It takes a lot of prints.
It's just a time management.
But I think
is that the only criticism I'm getting? Is that fantastic? Jim, you got to get them over to your house, and they're going to make their own prints.
How do you find that school of photography? Do you define it by the ideology?
No.
Do you define it by the...
I define it by the technique. Why do you accept blurb? Why do you accept blurb? The online books. You don't get to do the printing there.
The other thing I think we have exaggerated, if I may over my knowledge... But, SPOW has got digital printmaking courses in which people do print a lot.
Yeah.
So it's not as if it's totally hands-off printing.
No.
They go through a lot of prints.
It's a management issue. My students know how to work effectively in photographic printmaking. But what we don't have time for them to do is Command P. Just yet. Yeah, I know, but it's just that They're working on $10 a sheet of paper. These are kids that are living off of, you know, 99 cent past every day. So every time they put a piece of ultra smooth through the printer, that's $10.
Yeah. Well,
they can't. I have to make sure it's a success.
You don't do it that way.
And I don't. I mean, also my role is to give them reference. Eh?
I'm so efficient with my paper.
Yeah, I know, but
I do little scripts.
Oh, yeah, but you've been doing it for a while, right? Yeah, well, they haven't yet, so
I'll teach them. You know.
Okay, let's go back.
Okay.
Because to me, I'm not satisfied with the answer of how we define the school of thought. So if Spahl want to have a definition of what Spahl delivers, I think you have gotten there because at some point I could look at a picture and say, that's a Spahl picture. Those people went to...
You can do that, you said?
I think I did.
So then that's my fault, isn't it?
Yeah, you're guilty.
Okay, yeah, okay.
But how do you define that? Because I remember when, like way back when I was in school, and at some point you have to define yourself as an artist.
Yeah.
And the best compliment one of the head of the department gave me is, I put you through 2 years of hell, and I didn't grade you because you had your own style. Uh-huh. You never adapted the school style. So is it how the school, is it to grade people? So
no, I.
So where is it? What defines it?
I think what defines Spahl, I mean, if I had to put down to the nitty gritty, we're a composition school. We really, my interest for every student that comes out of that place is getting them visually organized. If they can become visually organized, then I got as a relate that to be able to visually organize, to get to a point that they get so visually organized that they can injure their compositions as well, so that they produce clean compositions, and then they have that ability to disorganize it and maintain the organization. We're a composition school. That's what we do. We account for every piece that comes out, for the most part.
But isn't it the way to, if you break out of the organization.
Well, okay, so Doris, what goes on then is exactly what you're happening.
We have
students that want to come to the school, and when they get into the school and they see what's going on, they say, Mike, stay away from me. Don't come near me. I don't want you to help me. I don't want it to look like this. I hate Irving Penn. They stay away. I don't even... Don't come, you're not touching the file, are you? Don't even touch it. You know, and I let them. I give them the playground to be on that. I mean, I'm overseeing them like an old grandfather, making sure that their intent is there, and there is a level of critical work that's coming out of them. But there is a rebellion within Spahl all the time, that they say, no. It doesn't have to look like this. It doesn't have to be like this. I want it to look like my work.
Because
right?
that becomes more like, I would say, if you're a student at art or you in fine arts.
Exactly.
The thing is to put so much, I don't want to use the word pressure, but to frame enough, but push enough for the student who has the potential with you as a true artist.
Yeah. I have to judge that on an individual basis.
Yeah, you have to.
I'm not big on freedom. I don't. There's two things I disagree with. The motto of OSA, that art is for everyone. I don't think art should be for everyone. That's a bad thing to say. I'll say that off the record. Come and take part-time classes. Say, but two, I don't know. I don't think I should give my students freedoms. I like putting them in prison so they can climb the walls and get out on their own and rebel. And say, Tardiola, I've had enough of you. I hate that direction.
Well, sometimes they do stuff that they don't want to do, and they do great stuff that they're made to.
And sometimes, some you have to understand, we don't get the best of the crop. So I'll take in anybody. Come on in, we'll do fine art. Well, they're limited. already. There are gifts that we have from some. There are gifted students from all ages. It has nothing to do with age. They're just some people are just visually gifted. They organize. They work it all out. So they have, there's the students that literally can't do anything. So we got to take other approaches in training. There's a level of emulation. They have to emulate in some way. Mm-hmm. They have to reference, right? Sorry, I'm speaking to the background. That's just a process. The goal is each student has to find their own process. Right? But there's criticism. I love the criticism. Trust me, I learn a lot from it. Because we get a lot of criticism about our approaches. There's no question about it. And we are limited in a lot of ways, but that's all we can do. I I bring in, I'm looking at the school from an apprenticeship point of view a little bit, that not all the students, but a lot of students work beside someone, they work beside me, wrong or right, because we hit them with big bad Michael Schreier, and that drives half of them crazy, and the other half love him. Tony Foose, half of them hate him, half of them love him. It all kind of, and in the end, though, they have to, I'm collaborating with them, and I have to make that judgment call. How much do I touch them, and how much do I lay back? And I'm just dealing with that now. I don't think it's necessarily the perfect way to do it, but
I mean, that's the way of the art school.
That's the way of the art school. I know we got a lot of people around us. I go to these board of director meetings, and I got to do I second, and it's all this civilized. And the more civilized the school becomes, the less civilized I want it to be. I'm afraid that it gets too organized. That we have to give students a playpen and just sort of let them lay there and they can paint the walls.
Is that Frisian generating content? How many of your students are generating content?
A lot of them, let's say the ones that are under 25, I don't know if they have the life experiences just yet to generate that content. That's another thing. Because the problem with the school, the biggest criticism of this silly place, a lot of the students do their best work at SPOW. And that's a big problem. They don't go on because I'm on them, help them, reference them, help them print, select, edit, everything. So work is coming out strong, and then it stops. And that's a criticism of me and the school.
I've taken some fantastic printing workshops at SPOW.
Yeah.
I commend you guys for what you're doing. I don't think SPOW can be everything in Ottawa and everyone. So I'm just going to throw this out to the whole group. I'm not from here, and I wonder if Ottawa has ever had an artist front center model that focuses on photography, because I think that's where they have to go after school. Because they do, one of the struggles that I had when I came here was, where do I get a dark room? I took the Silver Gelatin, so I could just print some.
That's a great point. I think EBA, its model is kind of interesting. It's neat. And why don't we have a place like that? Because that's the biggest problem, is the loneliness that occurs as an artist. That some can handle it, but I find a lot of people. Let's face it, 25% of the part-time culture, what we call hybrid classes, they just form little groups to get together, just not to be alone. It's like this.
Because I think Ottawa needs after step after school, for the temporary access to the dark room, whatever you need, is that space where artists can come together, like the space that we've created here for ourselves. But beyond the discussion, the critical dialogue, which is very important to any lifeblood of any art form, is that point of access to equipment that comes, and then you know, the distribution of the word, the exhibition of the word, that sort of thing. But has there never been?
Well, just before you go, digital technology sort of hurts that a little bit. We used to have this place in a process photo center. Remember this?
Yeah, you could rent out hours. There's a dance studio on top.
Now, yeah, and it was a place that you could do your own color printing.
Yeah.
Well, what a club that was. Professionals went there, and we met once a week, twice a week, to do our work, talk, complain. That was, in a sense, some sort of artist-run center. Digital technologies, everyone was working at home.
Yeah. There's a dark room in Dagmar, right?
Yeah.
And it's an artist-run center.
Yeah.
You can become a member.
Yeah,
but
you're not going to see Louis Helbig there. Right?
I was a member for a while, and it was absolutely not supportive. There was a language barrier for one, but I didn't cut the mustard as far as whatever it was that I needed to cut to be able to be part of the group. So I tried to take advantage of the printer, take advantage of the, you know, technique.
Because Gaimon is part of a larger umbrella group, the Independent Media Arts Alliance, right? Which is this Canada-wide organization. And it links its arm with SAW Video and IFCO. I just came from a board meeting at IFCO, the Independent Filmmakers Cooperative. Well, now, if they get Arts Court on the ball, and IFCO has the foresight to build a darkroom, that's a place where, because let's face it, moving image art, you know, the art of filmmaking, it is emotion-based, and for those of us who work with emotion, that's where we need to be, right? That's one thing. If you want to make mediated art, digital art, I don't know that there's a place for that anymore in funded artist-run centers. I think the funders are backing away from that because, as you say, the tools are in the hands of the people now. I think it's really interesting.
I'd just like to put a caveat on that. They are and they aren't. In fact, to own a wide-bed printer is not in the hands of general people. You want to do anything greater than 17 inches wide, you need a wide-bed printer, and you better be running a lot of prints.
You better use it.
Or that printer is an expensive brick in about 2 weeks. So, in fact, most people can't drive, you know, large works themselves. They do need a place. But there's businesses that, I don't include it, that will let them do that. But still, it's not that everybody does it at home. I would qualify that.
That's a good point. There's never been an
artist
photo-based art center.
Well, I was going to say, Raymond has got some experience because you're a director of a place that has that sort of thing.
I was. I'm not anymore.
You're not.
You
were.
It's a part of what you do.
In reality, in the early 1990s, there were quite a number of artists for a center that started photography because it was the 150th anniversary of photography, and the art world that moved into photography discovered photography at that point. Most of them took side paths and went somewhere else. Video, this, that, whatever, and there are very few left in Canada as a whole that are dedicated to photography.
Again, I just think this is wonderful. I disagree with some of what was said just now, for sure, but the fact that we're having a conversation about it. So again, we hit a point, you know. So I would say, you know, in some about, sure, there's lots of printers out there. I have a big one as well, too. I figured out the math, and it was cheaper for me to own my own printer and have the control to move, because no one, I didn't have the control all the way. So it's an artist decision, also a commercial decision. It makes sense for me to own a printer. You amortize it pretty quickly if you have a big printer. But the fact is that most of us don't know how to use those printers. And I work within certain parameters, get my work done, and that's about it. You know. So in fact, the level of ignorance, if you will, that could be that could be, you know, erased, or we could do very well by coming together around our large format printers to, you know, generate a conversation around technique or whatever else. It's yet one other little part of this whole puzzle. And again, in this conversation here, this stuff is popping up. Like, these things pop up. So what to do about these things that pop up? The differences of opinion and whatever else that go with it, what to do about those things to then move this whole thing forward in a way for ourselves, but also for the students that come out of SPOW, for SPOW itself, for the general public, for the idiots that run the public institutions that, you know, who are too busy, you know, whatever, to... there's a failure of imagination in the places where we would, I would argue, where we would hope there'd be some imagination. There's a categorical failure of imagination. But what could we do to push that along and, you know, to make something, make this a bit different, identify these issues and make something happen? You know, that's the crunchy bit here, you know.
Could I suggest that somebody type it up and send it around? Little pop-ups that have happened. Would you do it?
I don't have the time. I literally do have a lot of time right now, and when I start writing, it takes me days. So
okay.
It just takes forever. I mean, we have this taped here right now. I mean, in fact, I want to also point out something here.
I'll transcribe the tape. And transcribe the tape if that's what you.
Yeah, okay.
That actually might be the way to do it. Because
that would be.
I want to commend Michael here for doing this in terms of recording and putting this and his effort, taking his skills in broadcast, and a number of us have been the beneficiaries of being interviewed now as well too. But it is one of those, yet one more piece that sort of puts, you know, that is part of a larger jigsaw, and then we each bring a different set of skill set, the skill set that's being brought here. I mean, it can be done, and yeah.
For those that haven't noticed, Michael has photo commits, and it's a fascinating blog site. He's very serious about it, and he's doing really well with getting the interviews.
He's in the top 100 of the noteworthy section. This was last week.
Oh wow! Great,
and so it should be. So it should be. And I like these things too. That's fun.
Thanks.
Yeah, we're coming. Hey, thanks.